Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie zu einer Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, aufgezeichnet am Donnerstag, dem 3. Juli 2025. Ich bin verbunden mit der Stanford University in Palo Alto in der Nähe von San Francisco über viele Stunden Zeitverschiebung. Und ich bin sehr glücklich, dass wir einen renommierten Autor und Experten hier auf unserem Kanal haben. Es ist Abbas Milani. Abbas Milani ist der Direktor der Abteilung Iranian Studies an der Stanford University, einer der renommiertesten amerikanischen Universitäten. Und er hat unter anderem diese international gefeierte Biografie über den Schah, über den letzten Schah von Persien, über Reza Pahlavi geschrieben, und er hat da große Akklamationen erhalten. The Definitive Biography, The Scholarship is Impressive, Splendid Detailed Biography und so weiter. Er hat aber auch weitere Artikel und Bücher zum Thema Iran geschrieben, und wir unterhalten uns heute über diesen faszinierenden Staat, eine eigentliche Zivilisation, und auch über einige Fragen aktuell zum Nahostkonflikt. Und es ist natürlich sehr interessant, einen iranischen Forscher hier am Mikrofon zu haben, der heute in den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika tätig ist. Dr. Abbas Milani ist geboren 1949, eben ein iranisch-amerikanischer Historiker und Politikwissenschaftler und Autor, wurde im Iran geboren, absolvierte die High School in Oakland, Kalifornien, und promovierte in Politikwissenschaft an der University of Hawaii. Milani war Dozent an der Universität Teheran und an verschiedenen US-Hochschulen, Berkeley, Notre Dame und so weiter. Seit 2003 ist er eben Direktor der Iranian Studies an der Stanford University und zugleich Forschungsstipendiat und Co-Direktor des Iran Democracy Project an der Hoover Institution. Well, Dr. Milani, a warm welcome to you from Switzerland. Many thanks for your time in California. Is it as hot as here in Europe? Everybody's complaining about the heat. How is the situation at the West Coast?
At the West Coast, it isn't as hot as some of the other places in America. In the East Coast, there has been heat wave, but not here in California. In California, it's been the normal. At this time, it's about 75 to 80.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start with our topics. In your book, Lost Wisdom: Rethinking Modernity in Iran, you write that the Persian modernism goes back 1,000 years. How much of an influence is this huge cultural heritage in Iran today?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question. I think, in a sense, it's to me maybe one of the keys to understanding Iran today. There is a narrative, I'm sure you have this in Europe, Germany, France have been very prominent in articulating this view, the British, that modernity essentially, notions of humanism, notions of rationalism, notions of democracy are all creations of the West, and they have come to the world from the West. My argument has been, and I've made it in that book, and I've made it in a couple of other books in Farsi, my argument has been that that's a peculiarly Eurocentric view of the world. That if we actually go back and read Iranian texts from 9th century to 13th century, you see a lot of ideas that we would absolutely consider as modern, which were then very prevalent amongst Iranians, Iranian scholars, Iranian thinkers, Iranian philosophers, Iranian mathematicians, Iranian political thinkers, Iranian poets who articulated views that are humanist. I notice you introduced me in German. Some of the greatest German poets of all time, Goethe, was absolutely the embodiment of European Enlightenment, was absolutely driven to joy when reading Sa'di and Hafiz. Mm-hmm. He wrote his Eastern Divan. I just wrote a book last 2 years ago with the help of a colleague. We called it Sa'di and Humanism. Sa'di is the beloved of Goethe, of Victor Hugo. Hegel says that the light of reason begins in Iran. So there's a whole tradition of Iranian culture that hasn't been discovered or discussed. And the fault is essentially, I mentioned the Eurocentric tradition, but the fault is also mostly in us, in Iran. We haven't studied our own culture well enough. And we have allowed two groups of people to tell us a lie. One group are the clergy, who are against modernity, who are against humanism, who are against democracy, who are against equal rights for women, who keep saying these ideas are Western, and whoever advocates them are lackeys of the West. And there's another group of Iranians absolutely infatuated with Iran, who with the West, who might know German culture much better than Iranian history, who say, the only thing we need to do is emulate the West.
Mm-hmm.
I say we need to learn from the West. We certainly need to emulate from the West, but we need to first begin with self-knowledge. And once we do that, I think we would see that route. And that route, to me, is one reason why Iran has had, if you look at the Middle East, I don't think you would find another country that has had for 150 years a sustained democratic movement, sustained movement for women's rights, for equal rights, for religious tolerance. And that route sustains, I think, this movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. You have told me that you have been a political prisoner when you still lived in Iran under the Shah. How has this experience shaped your view of your country and probably also the tragedy Iran went through with and after the fall of the Shah regime?
One of the things that made my I spent a year in prison under the Shah, I was a leftist, and I went to prison for being a member of a leftist group. And I spent 6 months of that year in the infamous Evin prison, where my cell block mates were the future leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So almost everybody, with the exception of Mr. Khomeini himself, was out of the country. The top leadership of the clergy were in that prison. So I spent 6 months with them.
You talked to them?
Yeah, almost all of them. Mr. Montazeri was there. Rafsanjani was there. Talibani was there.
And you met them all in prison?
I met them on a daily basis. I played volleyball with them. I tried to teach Mr. Montazeri English. And he kindly answered my questions about theology. It was a wonderful man. I've written about this prison experience in a book that was just published. I wrote it first in Farsi. It's been now translated into English. Okay. It's called Simorgh, which is, again, a bird that has caught much attention in French and the German literature and those who are interested in Iranian tradition. In that prison experience, I knew what these people were like. I knew there were some of them who were tolerant, like Mr. Talighani, for example, like Mr. Montazeri. And there were others who were absolutely intolerant, dogmatic to the bone. And you could see if they have power, they will create the mess that they have created in Iran today.
Mm-hmm.
And I also could see how the leftists that I was a part of, and some of them were my cell mates, basically didn't understand Iranian society. Basically had a dogmatic view of Iranian society. I came from the Confederation, which was very, very powerful in the 60s and 70s in Europe, in Germany, France, lesser extent Switzerland. But our view of Iran, I think, was molded more by Maoism and Stalinism and sort of a limited view of Marxism than the reality of Iran. I think the Shah of Iran had made serious, substantial changes in Iran that we simply overlooked.
Yeah.
And we simply, I can speak for myself. I don't speak for anybody else. I think we fought the Shah to essentially to overthrow him without understanding that what might be waiting on the wing is the clergy.
I mean, that's a very interesting view that you're articulating. If you talk to people who have a better understanding of Iran than I have, they say, well, it was a tragedy that the Shah was actually thrown out in light of then the later developments. But what would you say now in retrospect? What is at the core of the tragedy of Iran? I mean, I understand that the Shah, he was educated in Switzerland. People from his entourage were saying he was actually an admirer of direct democracy, which was not what he practiced in Iran. But still, there seems to be some kind of nostalgia for the Shah. However, his regime was not successful. What is, in your view, the core tragedy? What went wrong under the Shah and what went wrong afterwards with these people you have met in prison?
What went wrong with the Shah, I think, and I have written in the Shah book, I've tried to explain this at great length, is that I do believe the Shah went extremely well for Iran. He wanted a powerful modern Iran. But what he, I think, failed to understand is that if you create a middle class, for example, as he did, you need to change the political structure. He did not change the political structure in a timely fashion, I think. But the more strategic error he made, and this is an error that he was not alone in making, all European countries made it, America made it, America even made it after the revolution. And that was the tragedy to think that in the fight against communism, in the fight against Soviet Union, Islamic forces are your allies. So they're your allies.
Yeah.
Under the Shah, virtually all democratic forces that were opposed to him, we're not allowed to participate. We're not allowed to organize. The only group that was allowed to organize, collect funds, have schools, have camps, have publishing houses were the clergy. And then when the system went into crisis, as it did in 77, 78, partly because the Shah was sick, partly because the opposition was, I think, foolish. The Americans were involved somewhere else. Carter was thinking about Camp David. It was sort of a perfect storm. When they suddenly realized, the Americans, the British, the French, the documents are there. I don't say these based on hearsay. They saw the Shah doesn't look like can it survive. Mm-hmm. Who can hold the country together? They said the clergy. Because the Shah had allowed them to create this network, and Khomeini had used that sort of freedom to actually organize a movement to overthrow the Shah.
The Shah nurtured actually his mortal enemy at the end.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Shah nurtured his mortal enemy because he believed, and he was, again, I don't want to just blame the Shah. I can give you examples from Europe, where in Europe they allowed radical Islamists till recently to organize, to have mosques, to have a mosque in European cities in the hope that this would be somehow an antidote to communism.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA, we know, was publishing Qurans in languages and sending them to Soviet Union because they thought this is what would undermine the Americans after 1979 supported the Islamists in Afghanistan and spent billions in training the Taliban in the hope that the Taliban would get the Soviets. The Taliban did get the Soviets, but they also came after the West. That's exactly what happened in to me in the shop.
And did you see, when you were at that time in prison with all these representatives of the later Islamic regime, did you see at that time that these were dangerous people who would push Iran, you could say, in a wrong direction?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You could see that. You could see clearly. Again, I have written about this. It's not just now that I say this. I've written about this many times in the book, Simor, in English. I've written the profile of Mr. Montazeri, Mr. Talleyrani. Yeah. You could see that the likes of Talleyrani were tolerant, understood pluralities of views. And the likes of Rafsanjani and they were out for power. They were, you know, opportunist, power hungry. And there were others who were absolutely dangerously dogmatic. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't touch us because we weren't in their view clean. Mm-hmm. All of the stupid laws they have in Iran now, they were enforcing in prison then. You could see. Yeah. But you could also see at the time, again, I've written about this, that how wrong Savak was. Two years before the revolution, 2.5 years to be exact, I heard it from Mr. Talleyrani himself directly, that Savak has made an offer to them, to the religious forces.
What's that, the secret police of the Shah?
Secret police of the Shah.
I mean, the power troopers, I mean, in the power army, the secret army, or power base.
It was
base.
A secret police. It was a combination of sort of the FBI and the CIA put together. Yeah.
Security apparatus.
The security apparatus, absolutely. And we in the student movement gave it a far more powerful image than it actually had. Mm-hmm. It was plenty powerful, and it was certainly brutal at times. It certainly used torture at times. Now, some of the defenders of the old Shah deny that there was even torture, which I think is a losing argument. The evidence is overwhelming. Clearly, we in the opposition exaggerated enormously about how much there was. But there was. You can't now, because we exaggerated, you can't go the other extreme and exaggerate the non-existence. Mm-hmm. But they offered the clergy the right, the opportunity to sign a letter to say that we will attack the monarchy as much as we'll attack Marxism. They said, mm-hmm. if you're equal in your attacks, we'll let you go. Some of them did. Mm-hmm. Mahdavi Kani did. He was freed on the day. I was freed on a pardon, mm-hmm. on a royal pardon. I was pardoned. Mahdavi Kani was pardoned on the same day. Mm-hmm. I and my ex-wife, who sadly just recently passed away, mm-hmm. drove him to his house on that day. He became a prime minister 2 years from then.
How do you explain the blindness of the West towards the Islamic movement at the time? Why did they not see that this was going to turn into a theocratic system, into an autocracy?
Well, again, I always like to begin by criticizing ourselves before we criticize the West. Most of the Iranian intellectuals didn't see it. Virtually the entire Iranian left lined up behind Khomeini, the Iranian Confederation, of which I was a member, used to praise Khomeini as this sort of remarkable combination of Gandhi and Mandela and Che Guevara and all of this. He was none of this. Khomeini was a defiant defender of reform in Islam. Mm-hmm. Khomeini, I think, is really the chief counter-reformation force. I was reading Isaiah Berlin about, he has written this brilliant book about this German philosopher of 18th century that was counter-reformation. Khomeini was that figure. When I was reading Isaiah Berlin and the counter-reformation in Germany, I said, this is Khomeini in Iran. But we praise them. We praise them as the great liberator. Mm. And we didn't understand it. The West obviously didn't understand it. The West, very few had ever read his book. Very few had ever studied the political history of contemporary Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Still, there's still not a single biography as we speak today. There isn't a single biography of Khomeini who really clearly follows the roots of his radicalism.
Highly interesting. You should probably write this book. How would you see the importance of Khomeini? Is he actually one of the significant figures of the last 50 years? I mean, with Khomeini, all his impact he had in the Islamic world coming out of Iran, how would you rate his importance?
Khomeini or Khamenei? Khomeini.
Khomeini.
No, I think to me, in fact, I'm writing a book about Reza Shah.
Okay.
One of my arguments is that there are two significant pivotal figures in 20th century Iran. They have two distinctly different paradigms of governance. One is Reza Shah, who wanted to curtail the role of religion, contrary to his son. And the other one is Khomeini, who wanted to dismantle the Constitutional Revolution, who did dismantle the Constitutional Revolution, who did not believe in popular sovereignty, which is the foundation of democracy. He believed in divine democracy. He was brutal and brilliant in fooling everybody, including the West. He was extremely disciplined. He gave 120 interviews in the 4 months he was in Paris. Not once does he mention the word velayat-e-faqih, about which he had written a book, and was the governance that he created once he came in power, which said, I am the law and you are sheep. I am the shepherd. Literally, he had written this book.
Mm-hmm.
90% of Iranian intellectuals, as far as I know, hadn't read it. It was bad under the Shah. This book was banned under the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
I would have required everybody to read it in the country.
So, I mean, when Khomeini came and the theocracy had a grip on power, how do you explain this? Because, I mean, as you mentioned in your opening statement, Iran is a country that is identified with thousands of years of culture. I mean, they were on such a superior level in antiquity, you know, ahead of the Greeks. I mean, there were some military encounters, of course, very famous in our history books. But still, I mean, you mentioned some of the Enlightenment figures in the intellectual tradition of Iran. And now we have this association that this kind of Middle Ages, Dark Ages regime of theocrats is ruling this beacon of enlightenment in the Middle East. Can you explain that? How was it possible for this mullah regime to be so long and so solidly, it seems, in power?
Well, first of all, let me ask you a question. How can Germany, of Beethoven, of Mozart, of Goethe, Marx, produce Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
Out of where did that come from? Cultures have a dark side.
Yeah.
Khomeini is the dark side.
The brighter the culture, the darker the backside.
Well, I haven't thought
probably,
about it that way.
Probably.
But there is that, you know, there is that question. And I think your question is absolutely right question, because I also think it's the right question to ask, where the hell did Hitler come from? Out of Weimar Republic, one of the most remarkable social democratic experiences ever in the world, one of the most fruitful 15 years that has produced all the great art and architecture and the theater, you get Goebbels and Hitler? That's and that's what we have in Iran. They haven't killed as many people as Hitler did, but they're as much the dark side of Iranian history as they were the dark side of Germany, I think. But the other thing is that Khomeini was very, you have to give him credit. He was very clever. He moved very methodically. He moved step by step. He used some of the left against the rest of the left. He used some of the left against the Social Democrats. He used left against the Iranian woman, the feminist, who said the question of hijab is not a serious question. We should concentrate on fighting imperialism. This is a petty bourgeois. Gradually weakened each one of them and brutally suppressed the last one who had helped him sort of eliminate the left, the Tudor party, which was very powerful in Germany before the war. East Germany was the center. Helped the Iranian regime destroy the rest of the left, because the rest of the left was no longer working with the regime, and the Tudor party was. And the Tudor party thought these people were petty bourgeois and counter-revolutionaries. And then they went brutally after Tudor party. Read the letter that the direct secretary general of that party, Keanu Reeves, wrote to Khomeini about how much he was tortured in prison. An 80-odd-year-old man. How much his wife, Maryam Firouz, a remarkable figure in modern Iranian history, a woman of aristocratic heritage who gives it all up, is sort of a Rosa Luxemburg type of a figure, and becomes a Stalinist, Marxist communist member. They tortured an 85, her husband, a defender of this damn regime, says, "Reed, shame on you to do this with us who were your supporters." So he moved very methodically. And I have to blame, again, after having blamed ourselves for not recognizing, I have to blame the progressive forces in the West for not coming to the help of Iranians, for not being willing to defend the right of Iranian women to fight for their rights. The silence of much of the progressives in the last 2 years, for example, about the movement, this remarkable movement by Iranian women to decide how they appear in public. The silence of many, many forces. If any other country had done this, I think the progressives would be absolutely up in arms against this Iranian regime.
As we speak,
is brutalizing the Afghans who have been exiles in Iran. They're accusing them of all manner of treason. They're sending them in en masse in tens of thousands. Where is the outcry? Where is the outcry of, and where is the support for what I think, clearly, in my view, the Iranian movement against the veil is the most successful civil disobedience movement we've had since Martin Luther King and his fight against racism in America.
In the famous book, I get it right here, the English title, I only know the German title, but the English title must be Power and Force by Hannah Arendt. Philosopher, she wrote that, a regime can rely on sheer force, but that's very expensive, and in the long run, they will not succeed. But if you have power, there is a certain sense of acceptance of your political structure. How would you rate this mullah regime now in Iran? How much acceptance is there still? How much legitimacy is there left with their theocratic way of justifying their power? And how much of it is just sheer force, you know, suppression of the people and violence against dissenters? I want to find out how strong this regime still has a hold on Iranian society.
You might be surprised, maybe you're not, you might be surprised to know that Hannah Arendt is one of the most beloved political thinkers in Iran.
Who is the Hannah Arendt?
Hannah Arendt.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Didn't know that.
Her books have been translated for many years from Origins of Totalitarianism. The banality of evil, the concept of the banality of evil has become part of the political, daily political discourse in Iran. Iranians are great readers. Iran, in terms of the number of books translated, I think is the number one, certainly in the Muslim world. And it's one of the top countries in the world. But Hannah Arendt is a very beloved figure exactly for the reason that you're articulating. She understood the nature of totalitarian beast, and people feel by their daily life the mendacities of this totalitarian, pseudo-totalitarian beast, and they know who understands them. I translated a novel 40 years ago from Russian. I don't speak Russian. I translated from the French and English, and somebody later compared it to the Russian, called Master and Margarita by Bulgakov. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant novel. Some people say it was the best novel in 20th century Russia. And it's about Stalinism and how the devil comes to Russia in Moscow. This has not gone into more than 40 prints. For almost 40 years, it's been one of the most read novels in Iran. There's five other translations of it. Because people feel that Bulgakov, in making fun of Stalinism, is making fun of this regime.
Yeah,
that one maybe was tragedy. This one is a comedy, but it's still in that same category. I think this regime is at the weakest it has been in 44 years.
Okay.
But it is still, it still has some base of support. I don't believe those who say this is bereft of all support. I think something between 15 to 20% of the people don't necessarily support the regime, but don't want it change because they're part of the system. They get rents from the system. They're worried about what tomorrow will bring. Dedicated people who out of belief want this system, I think they're extreme, extreme minority. I think the only reason they survive is fear.
Is fear.
Fear.
Yeah. The reign of fear.
And I think, again, that was one of the great services of the women's movement. They began to chip at this aura of invincibility of the regime. These regimes, the minute fear dissipates, they almost overnight disappear. People worry about what happened to Romania. Suddenly, he went from Ceausescu, went from the all-powerful to a sewer hiding. That's the regime. These regimes, their authority is chipped away gradually. And then suddenly there is a mysterious moment where people think, this regime has lost the ability to hurt me. Now I can come out in the streets. And then everyone is surprised how shallow the support was.
I mean, that's essentially what happened in Romania in 1989, when suddenly one guy out of the was crying out and calling the bluff off, and then it went down. So let's talk about current events now. I mean, what do you think about these interventions, the military interventions by the Americans against this nuclear program? What did you think when you heard about it, when you read about it? Was Trump right, President Trump, in doing so? What's your assessment here?
I have been for many, many years, and almost everything I've written and said, I've been against military attacks on Iran. I believe that, I still believe, that the solution of Iran's even nuclear program isn't ultimately military. You need a different regime in Iran for the nuclear program to be safe. With this regime, the nuclear program will never be safe. They will cheat, they will lie, and they will reconfigure at great expense to the people of Iran. So I wasn't happy that they attacked, but I also wasn't surprised because Netanyahu has been essentially itching to attack Iran because he feels that Iran is a threat to Israel. And he feels that because Iran constantly threatens the destruction of the state of Israel. Yeah. It doesn't have to conflate the story. The Iranian regime, Khamenei, 2 weeks ago, last week, the paper closest to Khamenei said the destruction of Israel is our goal and it's going to remain our goal.
Why are they saying this, by the way? I mean, why are they so much focusing on that? I mean, since they must know that this exactly is the reason why they have been so fiercely attacked now by the Americans and, of course, by Israel. Do they mean it? Is that the essence of their, is that their raison d'etat, the destruction of Israel at the end of the day?
That's why I wasn't surprised that the attack occurred. You've been calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. Again, I wasn't in favor of the attack. I don't still believe that that's the solution. But I completely understood. You've been attacking Israel for 35 years. You've been amassing military, 200,000 missiles on Israeli borders, as Iran had in Lebanon and Syria. And Israel is watching, and they see that your proxies are destroyed, your ally in Syria is gone, people in Iran are against you, the economy is on the verge of collapse, there is a truckers' strike, nobody, including Russia or China, are coming to your help. You think Netanyahu is not going to attack? And you think Mr. Trump is not going to then join at the last moment to try to finish. So I wasn't at all surprised. I'm surprised that they still haven't learned any lesson, and they keep repeating the same mantra over the last week. If you read Iranian sources, as I sadly have to do, they declared that they won the war. They say, we brought Israel and the United States to their knees. I'm almost verbatim quoting. They begged us to accept. Yeah. This is the official reading of what happened. Sorry.
And the people believe that if they're saying that?
Laugh at it. People understand. People of Iran are clever. People understand. People who are being attacked, Israeli planes were flying over Tehran like it was Tel Aviv. There was no air defense against them. Israel had an open access to almost everything in the country for 12, 14 days. No Iranian, in Iran particularly, cherishes that. But I know a lot of people in inside Iran who said, now that Israel has attacked, we wish they could have finished this. These people. There are some who have come to rally around the flag, clearly, particularly regime defenders who are now trying to create a kind of a patriotic movement in defense of the regime. But Mr. Panahi and Mr. Rasulov, two great filmmakers who are very well known to your audience, I'm sure. Ms. Ebadi, Nobel Prize winner, Nargis Mohammadi, almost a Nobel Prize winner, and two other people signed a very interesting announcement very early in the war. They said no to war. No to this regime, and no to enrichment. That was a very, I thought, brilliant, because they recognized that enrichment has only a weapon purpose. Yeah. You can't go down that road and spend so many billions and billions without having a military component. And clearly, they didn't want Iran to be attacked. And clearly they knew, as I know, at least I do for myself, that so long as this regime is in power, these kinds of calamities will happen to Iran regularly.
So should the West do something about it, or is that a mistake? I mean, the intervention, or should they just, let the Iranians get rid of their regime when the people are ready? What's your recommendation? How should the politicians in the West you know, what should they do? What would be the right policy towards Iran now?
Well, I think the right policy should have always been, still is, to make it clear, first of all, to the regime that they're not considered a normal part of the global discourse. This mm-hmm. is a regime that, as we speak right now, they've taken several Europeans hostage again because mm-hmm. they want to release with exchange. Europeans, without fail, have over 40 years traded Iran when Iran has abducted innocent citizens from Europe or dual citizens in return for the terrorists and operatives that the Iranian regime had in prisons. If they, from the first moment, had said, we're not going to negotiate, if you abduct another citizen, we're going to close your embassies, all of this wouldn't have happened. Europe and America, I think, have to develop a strategy about Iran and decide whether they want the Iranian people to rule Iran or whether they want this regime. Mm-hmm. They want Iranian people, my view is, there are others who have different views. My view mm-hmm. is that let the Iranian people do the job. They can do the job. Yeah. If the West and essentially doesn't help this regime continue its egregious behavior, if they mm-hmm. make it pay for when it breaks the law, for when it goes brutally against its own people. For example, right now, the international community can help break the regime's hold on the social media in Iran. Mm-hmm. Things like Starlinks can break the censorship of the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime is buying technology from China, from Russia, to essentially oppress people, name, mm-hmm. face recognition. They're giving all kinds of help without interfering in Iran, without putting boots on the ground in Iran. The West can equal the playing game by mm-hmm. making Iranians capable of organizing.
But do you think Israel and, you know, allied with the United States, that they were right in attacking this nuclear infrastructure? Because given what you have just said about the nature of this regime, it would be extremely dangerous if these people got a grip on the nuclear bomb and then of course, solidifying their power and also being able to influence events in the Middle East in a not very positive way.
Well, you know, the right or wrong is different. I can say only one thing. I'm absolutely not surprised that they would attack it. Mm-hmm. It would take a foolish politician in Iran mm-hmm. to look at the reality. And I think Mr. Khamenei was foolish in these things. Mm-hmm. I wrote an op-ed in Project Syndicate that mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago. I said that we have a saying in Farsi that says a madman throws a stone down a well, and it takes 10 wise men and women to bring it out. And that stone has been thrown in the well by Mr. Khamenei. And now even 10 wise people can bring it out. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Allow this regime to have a bomb? I, as an Iranian, and I can only speak for myself. I have no capacity to speak for mm-hmm. anybody else. I don't want this regime to have a bomb. I don't want anybody to have the bomb. I don't want Israel to have the bomb. Mm-hmm. I want nuclear bombs to be banned. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want 18 Muslim countries in Middle East and 15 other countries to be added to the nuclear club. I'm sorry that there is a nuclear club. So I don't mm-hmm. want that. And strategically thinking, as far as I understand, I'm not a military strategist. A nuclear bomb, Iran, one or two nuclear bomb, is not going to give this regime the deterrence it needs. Mm-hmm. This regime's, first of all, biggest threat is the people of Iran. They don't want you. That bomb is for the Iranian people much more than it is. This regime knows Israel has 200 bombs.
What are the tendencies in the
I need to go in 5 minutes. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Very, very quickly. What is the what gives you hope that there are internal tendencies in the Iranian society that could topple this regime? Where are positive signs, positive developments you could name?
To me, the most positive thing that I saw in the last, I'll give you what was positive to me in the last 15 days, 16 days. People of Iran were brilliant and prudent in showing they don't like the war, they don't want the war, but they also hate this regime.
Mm-hmm.
And they find this regime to be responsible for all of this. They didn't help, they didn't come into the streets to overthrow the regime. They also didn't come into the streets to say, hello, long live the patriotic mm-hmm. land of Iran. The regime just organized the ceremony for 30 of its top military intelligence cadres. They couldn't get 20,000 people in the streets to do it. They got 1 million when Soleimani was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are 30, none of them are, maybe Bagheri is at the level of Soleimani. Bagheri was a very, I think, powerful person. The 30 of them, they can't get 20,000. That's the Iranian people showing this regime, we don't want you.
Yeah.
They said no to war, and they said no to the regime. And it takes a brilliant, prudent people to do that. And that gives me optimism.
And one last question. Iran has a Islamic society. And if this regime goes down, what's next? And my question is now from a Central European Swiss perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the question is, how much are Islamic societies compatible with democracy?
Well, first of all, Islamic societies is a rather vague figure. Afghanistan is an Islamic society. Turkey is an Islamic society. Morocco is Islamic society, and Malaysia is Islamic society. These are Indonesia is Islamic society. So there isn't one, mm-hmm. and there isn't one Islam. There are Islams. I teach a course actually on this topic, mm-hmm. Iran Islam, and I begin by saying there's nothing called Islam. There are Islams.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely. Khomeini, Khamenei, ISIS, Muslim Brotherhood type of Islam is fundamentally, philosophically incompatible with democracy.
Yeah.
But Iran, in my view, was never really as Islamic as everybody thinks Iran was. Iran created Shiism essentially against Islam. That's a very long history. There are mm-hmm. books, read Henri Corbin, 5 volumes on what is called Islam Iranian. And the basic premise of it is that Iranians took radical Islamic ideas and infused it with elements of Zoroastrianism and created something that was entirely different. I think Iran today is the least religious society
mm-hmm.
in the Muslim world. There's some polls. Gaman has done a poll, one of the most reliable polls. The number of people who want any kind of a religious role in religion is less than 20% in Iran today. Far more percent in America. I don't know about Switzerland, but America, if you do the poll, Iran would be more secular. I need to run. I'm sorry. Very
okay. Well, Dr. Milani, thank you very much for your insight and wisdom. Wish you all the best, and hope we can continue the conversation
absolutely.
At some
it
other
would be
time.
A pleasure.
Thanks
it
a lot.
It would be a pleasure.
Okay. Have a great day.